Welcome to the Outrider Podcast. I, of course, am Jason Quinn Malott, and this is Shop Talk number 6 with my friend Laura Hawley. We had a really good conversation, I think, this time, and not quite as much with the umming and the big long pauses, although I might be hypersensitive to it sometimes. We'll see. This one sounds a bit better. I feel like we had a better conversation. We talked about all sorts of things. My brief 2.5-3 week obsession with Californication. Yeah. But anyway, so here we are, 2015. It's a brand new year. Way to go, Captain Obvious. I hope you all are writing well and have things planned. I've got a few plans going. We'll see how those work out. Trying to get my shit together and submit more often. That will help tremendously. And try and get some more projects finished. Might as well have a stack of manuscripts to send out. Yeah. Right, so let's get to the conversation with Laura Hawley.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello. Sorry, I didn't mean to rush you.
Oh, no, that's fine. I was sitting around not doing much at the moment. You know, which is fine and dandy. I was playing with a new possible recording device, and it wasn't working out. So we're back on the old standard, which is GarageBand.
Yay! Okay.
Anyway, so how have you been?
Good.
Good.
Got through the holidays, and yep.
Didn't happen to write anything, did you?
No. I've been thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, as long as you keep thinking about it.
Yeah. I started, there's one of the guys I work with, we were talking about James Dean, and I told him my idea for my fictional biography about James Dean. I got all excited. I was like, yeah, I could do that. And he's like, that's awesome, you should do that. I'm like, I should.
Yes, you should.
So, what have you been doing?
Oh, you know, being sick. I just on the back end of a 2 week long cold or something. I don't know. I never really got stuffy, but there was a lot of sneezing.
Yeah.
You know, and really lots of fatigue. I, you know, being hypochondriac there for a while, I thought I had mono, but
yeah.
You know.
Well,
it's really hard to tell whether or not my malaise is just a general feeling or if it's from a virus. But you know, that's how it goes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. When you've got a disease, is fatigue and malaise are the two of the major symptoms. And it's like, then I've had mono for 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. How funny.
So have you, what have you started reading since the last time we talked?
I went to Amarillo, Texas.
Oh, yeah?
And at the airport, I picked up a book, and I'm very leery about picking up books at the airport. Kind of like picking up strange people in a bar. You just never know.
Yes,
so
yes.
I'm like, this one seemed good. It was called On Such a Full Sea.
Oh, Chang Rae Lee.
Yeah, Chang Rae Lee. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks pretty interesting. It's kind of long, you know. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what it's about.
Uh-huh.
Because it's just an interesting storytelling technique that he has in the book.
Right.
I'm not very far into it, of course, because, you know, I start something, I don't finish anything. but, you know, I wasn't totally disappointed with my purchase, so.
Oh, well, good, good. Yeah, when that first came out, they had a special edition hardback that came in a one of those printed cases, like a plastic printed 3D printed cape slipcase. What the fuck, Jesus Christ! I was trying not to brain fart, you know. With this
right.
Today, but that's okay. Yeah, a 3D printed slipcase. They had this weird, you know, kind of relief of the title on the case, so it was all printed in this funky white plastic. It It was pretty cool. It was like $150. I was like,
holy shit.
No.
Yeah, no.
No.
No. But yeah, I never heard of them. I probably should have, but, you know, not in touch with things these days, and it sounds interesting.
Oh, well, good. I hope you like it. Let me know what you think of it.
Yeah.
I'm a back. Kind of,
Also, he's kind of telling the story like of a legend,
right?
In their area, you know, it's like you know, the legend telling. It's interesting. So.
Yeah, I heard quite a bit about it.
Okay, well, that's good to know.
So you're on the right track.
There's more hope.
Yeah, I'm almost finished with that. Bonnie Zobel book that I had started a while back, which is, it's pretty good. You know, they're all interconnected short stories and a novella, you know, centered around this neighborhood in San Diego, where in the middle 70s, there was a collision between a passenger liner and a Cessna. And the passenger liner crashed into this neighborhood, took out a bunch of houses and killed a bunch of people on the ground as well.
That's an interesting premise.
So that tone of that horrible tragedy kind of overlays these interconnected short stories,
huh.
And it's pretty good.
Cool.
So yeah, I'm hoping I might be able to get her on the podcast and talk to her here in the future.
Well, yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, and then I should have started this book a long time ago, which is really kind of unfortunate. There's a press out there called the Concord Free Press, and they've got this interesting premise where they distribute their books for free, on the condition that you take the book, you make a donation to a charity or to the press or whatever, and then when you're done with the book, they've got a page on the back that you sign it, and then you pass the copy on to someone else, and they make a donation and do whatever. And I have shamefully been sitting on my copy of Scott Phillips. And haven't made my donation or passed it on yet because I haven't read it yet. So I need to.
Yeah.
I'm getting that read. And then moving on to some other stuff. But
good.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. I'm really liking it. You might like it if you can find a copy around somewhere, or maybe I'll send you my copy. After I finish it.
There you go, sign it and send it to me. Yeah, there you go.
Donation.
I can even find anybody that reads.
Right.
Oh, I know somebody that reads.
And so, yeah, it's actually set in Colorado.
Oh, neat.
One of the few times he's set a book outside of Wichita.
Okay. Where in Colorado?
In one of the mountain resort towns near Boulder.
Oh, okay. Ew.
Yes. So, but it's a
cool.
It's a dystopian book, so it's set some way into the future. Society.
I can keep up with my trend. Yep.
Yeah, society is partially collapsing. All that good stuff, you know.
Cool. The trifecta. I can have Jason 11 on such full freedom in his book. It's like when I read Brave New World, Catch 22, 1984.
Right.
I'm like, Jesus Christ, I'm paranoid.
Yeah.
It's gonna get me. But anyway. Yeah, it sounds good.
All right. Yeah. I got a. But other than that, did you ever watch Californication on Showtime or pick it up on Netflix?
I never did.
Do you have
I did see your post about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have Netflix. Or I used to have Netflix.
Okay. You know, David Duchovny. Is the
story, yeah, I love him.
And I just finished the seventh season, so that's all seven. It was very good, very good. But
uh-huh.
I had the same kind of experience with that TV show that I had with college.
Okay.
Right. So when I was in high school, there was a movie that came out with starring Val Kilmer called Real Genius. Do you remember
uh-huh.
that? Did you ever see that?
Yeah.
He plays,
I don't think I ever saw it, but I remember it.
Physicist, really smart physicist kid who's kind of slacking around, and this child prodigy who's, you know, barely 15, you know, shows up at campus, and they you know, have wacky hijinks adventures. You know, they create a bobsled track in the middle of the dorm, and it only lasts for like 15, 20 minutes or so before of the sledding ice, you know, dissipates and evaporates or whatever. And there's one scene where Kilmer's, you know, he's got on his tank top and his Bermuda shorts and big fuzzy slippers, and he's walking around in this little, like snack room, break room thing in the dormitory, and he's carving these thin, coin shaped, you know, ice wedges off of this thing. It's probably liquid nitrogen or something like that that's frozen, whatever, and he's dropping them in a vending machine. Right? And I was, you know, naive kid, I was obsessed with that movie, and I wanted my college experience to be fun like that. And I was horrible.
Oh.
And the thing was that it created for me an unrealistic expectation of I allowed it, along with some other movies, to create this unrealistic, you know, Animal House in particular. You go to college to learn, and I did learn, but I was rather disappointed that, you know, that I can, after 5 years of college, can really count my, I don't even need a full hand to count the number of really, truly legendary wild parties that I was a part of.
Yeah.
When I was in college, and it's like, I feel like I missed out. But I guess that's what alcohol does to you, is it blottos those recollections.
Yes.
Anyway, so you would think that all these years of actually trying to do the work of being a writer, that I wouldn't be swayed by the fiction of a writer in that series. And all I kept thinking as I'm watching this is, like, why isn't my writing life this interesting? Or my non-writing, struggling to writing life? And I'm thinking, well, partly because I'm in Kansas, and partly because I'm not David Duchovny.
Well, yeah. Who is David Duchovny? I mean, really, he's like on his own little plane of existence.
But, and if you watch the series, and people that have seen it might think this is kind of strange and bizarre, but all I kept thinking through the whole thing was, like, where's my Runkle? And Charlie Runkle is the main character's agent. David Duchovny plays Hank Moody, the writer, and his agent is this guy named Charlie Runkle, played by Evan Handler. And he's a hoot. He's massively screwed up, but he's this incredibly loyal, you know, agent and best friend to the writer. And I kept thinking, well, where's my Runkle?
Wow. Yeah. Right?
You know? Not that I want a masturbating agent, but I would like a loyal agent. You should watch it. It's fun.
It sounds funny. I know when it first came out, I was like, oh, David Duchovny, because I love him. And I was like,
right.
I don't have Showtime, so I just never watched it. But I do like Showtime shows. I liked Weeds, and I absolutely adored Dexter. That was awesome.
Oh, yeah.
I love Dexter.
No, it's all 7 seasons are on Netflix right now.
I'm going to have to check it out.
But yeah, it's completely it's tinkered with my expectations again. You know, it's not that. I don't know. I think it's because I think here's my theory, and I'm coming up with this theory partly on the fly and partly something that I've been thinking about all day. And I think if I lived in a city that had a legitimate, a serious, a lively literary scene, my susceptibility to the Hollywood fiction that is Californication would be severely diminished. I wouldn't fall prey to it. But since I'm out in this kind of barren wasteland in Kansas, this idea that there is some place where the lowly writer, you know, with a couple of interesting books under his belt, might suddenly find himself at a drunken rock and roll party somewhere with lots of naked women is is like, that's like, I shouldn't be having that fantasy at 43. Right?
Oh God.
I should be wise enough to look at that and go, yes, that's a fiction. I could write that. That's not how life really is. Go sit down. Go work on your novel that you've been staring at and contemplating for the last week because you're stuck on one particular scene trying to turn. I've got that one scene where you kind of need it there for a transition. But it's just absolutely flat, dead, and mechanical.
Oh.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's in the Tulsa book. I have this thing where mm-hmm. we're skipping right over. We're going right on to working on and writing and planning here.
That's fine.
The one of the main characters has to go to the police station to look at this evidence taken out of the time capsule where they found this dead body. So he has to do that. And this scene is the scene where that sets that up. And at one point I took it out. I had it completely removed and I had gotten like three chapters beyond it and was like going, wait, how the fuck did he get here? And how the fuck did this other character get to the library? Because in order for the one character to get to the library, he has to ride with the person who's going to the police station.
Okay.
Because there's one car and they're together and it's a father-son thing. The father has to go to the police station. The son, he's just kind of hanging out. And he's got to go somewhere, and right across the street is the library. So he goes there. But I have to get them there. And this right. is... You know, it's the whole logistics of trying to tell a story. And I thought about trying to get rid of that and just put that at the beginning of the chapter where the kid shows up in the library. But that chapter mm-hmm. is after the one where the father shows up at the police station.
Oh.
Right? So, mm-hmm. yeah, I still need to explain why the dude shows up at the police station.
You can't just have him appear there?
Yeah, because he's a person of interest. He's not a suspect, but he's a person of interest.
Okay.
So and it seems I could have the police go and find him, but that would be a bit fantastical. Yeah. And it just makes it easier for the cops to like call him up on his cell phone and go, "We need you to come by the station," and he's innocent, so of course he's going to cooperate. But the cops don't know that he's innocent yet; they're still thinking he might be a suspect, right? So, yeah, I've got to try and make this one scene function. Without it,
how is it built right now?
Well, right now, the character is coming out of a nursing home after visiting an uncle, and the scene opens up with him in the park, walking in the parking lot, and his cell phone rings. And then, after that, it's everything that's in there. After that point is logistics. It's not right. It's like, you know, he takes the phone. He has the, you know, part of it is having the conversation with the detective.
Okay.
So I'm skipping most of that, or I thought I did, and then I ended up writing stuff, and then I don't know. And then I've got to get him in the car and across town because it's in that. And he's there at the nursing home with his cousin, his cousin's husband, his son, and his cousin's daughter.
Okay.
So there's
a lot of people.
They're all, because they all of these five people went to visit the uncle that's in the nursing home. So I have John, the main character, his son, Blake, and then John's cousin, Angela, and her husband, and her daughter, all at the nursing home leaving when he gets the phone call. So I've got to, at some point, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is what should happen that's important and relevant that can occur while they're doing the logistical thing of going across town in a van.
Could they have a meaningful conversation?
That's what I'm trying
to.
That's what I'm
bit of information come out.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. Is
to kind of to necessitate the actual logistics, because, right. Like, I'm the queen of making things short, which is why I can't write a novel. I would have just said, and he arrived at the police station, and then he went to the police station.
Right.
You know, it's the whole thing.
Right. Yeah, and you know that's. That's part of the thing, is what kind of meaningful conversation, what needs to come out at this point?
Or it could be, it doesn't have to be like a mind blower, like, oh, okay, but it could be something
right.
subtle that
oh,
you
no,
use
yeah,
later,
it's
right?
To trickle. What needs, and that's what I've been dwelling on, is what needs to come out, what needs to happen. And this is also a good time for me to get rid of some, we talked about this before, it's also a time for me to get rid of some of that, that Scooby-Doo effect.
Yeah.
That I'd had the, this character Blake involved in, you know,
right,
of trying to solve the mystery.
Yeah.
But yet I still have to get him into the library because he has to meet the daughter of his father's high school best friend again. And she works at the library. So he has, I mean, that's that, and that's despite their Scooby-Doo elements of the, of their story, the logistics at this point of their story are pretty simple. She worked at the library. He ends up at the library. That starts there, because the only other time they've met is when she when the daughter confronted the character John at the in the first scene and slapped him and called him a murderer. I need to send you the manuscript, I think.
Yeah, you do. You do. Send it to me.
But, yeah. Yeah, so I've been sitting there on this. And before that, I was sitting on a couple of other scenes and just spending a lot of my mornings just staring at the computer and resisting the urge to surf the net and try and focus on that one, you know, plot dilemma. What needs to happen here?
Yeah.
And then making sure that it's compelling and that the writing isn't mechanical, journalistic, you know?
Yeah, you're making me think of something that Keith told us.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember how, I'm going to butcher his story because he was a good storyteller and I'm going to forget how he told us the story. But he's talking about this, he's writing this book or writing this story, and this kid, like, cut his head on the headlight or something, like crashed, like got hit by a car and the headlight broke and got stuck in his forehead. And then basically the moral of the story is like, that's why that happened. And that's kind of what I feel like you're trying to get to, is that that's why that's there.
Right.
You know? And it's, I don't know.
Yeah.
It'll have, it's, I mean, when I read it, I can probably give you a better insight into what I'm trying to say, but.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, that's the thing I'm trying to, you know, that's the hard thing right now is coping with distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the distraction is of my own making. I mean, I have not, this feels like a horrible thing to say, but I'm going to say it. And it feels like I've got, what have I got up here on the wall? I've got one, two, three, I've got three stories that I want to write. But for some reason, somehow, none of them have reached out really and grabbed me by the throat and said, you have to write this, you know? Or if they've done it, they've really quickly, you know, lost the strength in their grip.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah.
I don't know why that is. I don't know. I don't know if it's because I'm dissipating my energies on three stories, if I'm dissipating my energies, you know, by fighting that urge to dawdle and to surf the net and watch TV and you know,
damn technology.
And
I'm serious.
Well, not just the technology, but because I don't know. there was about a week and a half, a 2 week period at one point where my internet dawdling was specifically focused on dating websites. And I was able to justify that as, well, this is useful because we all need, you know, to find someone who gives a shit about us. So this is important.
Yeah.
Right?
That's true.
And,
yeah.
But it's like, what? That's this kind of sick rationalization of wasting your writing time. You know, it's my precious 2 hour window, you know, between 5 and 7 in the morning.
Yeah.
And when I have to put words on the page and to tweak those words and to play with those and sit and think about a story when my mind's clear before the day comes in and crowds it all up, and I'm wasting it thinking, oh, she's cute. What? and rationalizing that to myself as if somehow that's useful to my life. I don't know.
I feel you.
Oh, well.
I don't know. I'm, you know, I obviously am not writing, so I can't tell you that what you're doing is bad.
Yeah, I know. It's all right. I mean... That's
kind of that feeling of having a story come at you and you're like, oh my God, I gotta write this thing, and I'm just kind of going,
yeah.
Maybe not.
But on the other hand, I realize that one, I write slow, so I know I'm not worried that I don't have a massive amount of page numbers at a certain time.
Uh-huh.
Right. But, and you know, over the years, I've written a lot of stuff. I've cranked out, you know, 60,000-70,000 words on a piece and discarded it.
Yeah,
and that's 250 pages.
Uh huh.
Right, and thought, that wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah.
So it's not like I haven't generated material. I haven't generated material that I felt went anywhere, except for the Palace of Winds, which I'm trying to, you know, pushing out to agents and publishers, which mm-hmm. I need to get back on the ball on. Because I think, you know, after a year of no response from some of these, they're just not going to respond.
Yeah, you're not going to get a response, yeah.
And I'm the worst when it comes to query letters. I'm so damn self-conscious about them.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, I have a manuscript out there. Maybe I need to, and that's the other thing is, you're like, well, I feel like I'm just kind of oscillating in one position
mm-hmm.
and not actually moving anywhere, I'm just blowing on this over here and then switching over and blowing on that over there and switching over and blowing on that over there. And nothing's moving. Nothing's changing. I'm just, you know, ooh, there's my attention over here.
And yeah.
I don't know how to.
Oh.
Yeah, and then I worry about burnout because what that feels like is I'm sitting there going, you're not producing, you must produce, and beating myself up, which leads to burnout when you're putting pressure on yourself to do something that's and it's not happening, and you put more pressure on yourself, and then it still doesn't happen. So you put more pressure on yourself, and it still doesn't happen, and that's burnout.
Yeah.
And Right, so I have anxiety over that.
Yeah.
Fuck it, Laura. Just fuck it.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. That's the way it goes.
But I think it's normal. I think it's you write so much and you've been writing for so long. And so with so much dedication, there's got to be a point where, not that you stop doing that, obviously, but you just kind
Right.
of get to a point where you're like, God damn it. Give me a break. Catch me a break here. Because you're not getting any response either
Well, I'm not getting any res. Yeah.
on Palace of Wind. So it's like, you're not getting the response. So there's that feeling of, in the back of your mind, maybe this is, for me, it would be like, well, what did I do wrong?
Yeah.
Why waste my time on this?
Well, I'm not
Is this not
getting.
working or?
I'm probably not getting any response for maybe two reasons. The first one is that I'm not submitting. I'm not sending it out as frequently as I should.
Okay.
And Rachel Weaver talked to me about this when she was in Wichita for her book, and we had our little conversation to record a podcast. Is that, she had a ritual that she would go on over, over a month for. She had this set number of submissions she would send out, and I. So that's part of it. One is that I don't submit as frequently as I should. I don't just, line them up, blast off a 10, 20 submissions at a time,
Yeah.
and get lucky that way. And then the other one comes down to just that. Like I said before, that kind of anxiety and hyper self-consciousness about my query letters. And I think this goes back to probably some bad teaching I got early on as a writer, before I even got to graduate school. In particular, reading articles in Writer's Digest about how to write query letters, because invariably in Writer's Digest, the articles on how to write query letters are geared towards people that are writing genre fiction, that are writing, mysteries and suspense and thrillers and romance. And so they have kind of built into their plot a hook. What would you do if the doctor left a scalpel in your penis? Right? And they can and that's how and they can lead their query letter with some mastermind criminal breaks into Fort Knox with a toothpick and a rubber band. Ooh. That gets the, and that's the way those articles, at least when I was reading them back in the 80s and 90s, were geared towards. Is this is how you write a query letter. And literary novelists don't always have that kind of hook. When they dabble in genre, when they pull genre things into their literary novel, they can kind of get that hook and get an agent's attention. Like when Michael Chabon decided he was going to, when he wrote, I'm sure he and his agent had a great query letter with a nice hook on it when he wrote the Yiddish Policeman's Union, which was, this semi-dystopian futuristic novel where instead of, Palestine and Israel being the homeland for the Jews, it had been Alaska.
Okay.
Right. And or when Emily Mandel, came up with the concept for Station 11, I'm sure that her and her agent had a real great easy hook, with that type of with making a certain genre type, prominent in a story. And I haven't really done that yet. I haven't gotten to my story where I'm taking a genre and bending it to some other story that I want to tell.
Right.
So I don't, it's, how do you write a hook? I mean, maybe I have it and I just haven't figured out how to do it. You know, I'm retelling the story of Jason and the Golden Fleece with the Palace of Winds and bringing in elements of my grandfather's biography. Is that relevant? Mm-hmm. It's in my query letter. Should I put it there? But it seems, but nobody has. I've popped the query letter around a few people, and it seems okay the way I have it, but doesn't seem to be working. You know?
Yeah. Was there like a line or two of writing that you've done in there that is just like, that would, you know, if you put that at the beginning, would that stand out? Hmm. Get somebody's attention?
That's an interesting idea. Maybe. I don't know. I could...
Like a quote. Kind of just like a quote from the story, just, you know, like just right. Something that just to demonstrate I can write, you know, because I think that's what's going to sell.
Well, you know,
your book is that you can write.
I've got the previous publication. I think that proves I can write.
Well, that too, that helps.
You know,
a big difference, but it's like your hook, maybe just even the line from the book,
right. Yeah, we'll see. It's I've got a I think I spend more time agonizing over and dwelling on and questioning my query letter than I do the manuscript.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the query letter creates more anxiety and self-loathing and
well, that's like the most personal thing about the whole manuscript thing is like this is your introduction to the manuscript.
Right.
You know?
So and it's the introduction to me. Okay.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. It's a personal thing. I can see that.
And this I guess I suppose is why I see there's so much, why the conference like Breadloaf and things like that are so damn important. And maybe this year I need to make an effort to actually plan some vacation time around going to someplace like that or applying to someplace like that in a larger city and actually
I think you'd enjoy that,
take advantage of meeting of the opportunity to meet an agent or an editor or something and go, listen, my query letters suck, so let me get you drunk.
Yeah.
I think that's the only way
that's
going
to
work.
That's a great way to start. Yeah, hey.
That would
make sense, too.
And I would probably find my runkle that way.
Probably.
Yeah, so maybe that's what I need to do this year. I mean,
yeah, I think that would be a good idea. I think you'd probably benefit from going to one of those.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, you know, maybe the reason that it's so hard to, and I also, like I said before, maybe it's burnout. Maybe I'm pushing too hard, or it's just the weight of working and not getting the right amount of return. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about financial because I know all the self-publishers who like to hate me would hear that and go, yeah. Well, you should just self-publish. And I go, I don't self-publish because I suck at marketing and I don't have the money to publish a book the way I would want it published.
Yeah.
So I'm going to a publisher
yeah.
who will print the book for me and do all this other stuff, whatever, and hire a publicist.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. The stuff that I'm bad at. I mean, when I had my conversation with Fred Ramey for the podcast, we yet again bumped up against my self-deprecating tendency. You know, he absolutely hates it. He hates it when I, you know, say something like, you know, except for my book, Unbridled's list is really strong.
Oh.
Right. And that just kind of is like this knee-jerk reaction on my part to kind of like just, yeah. You know, don't sound like you're bragging about yourself. Don't sound like you're tooting your own horn. And that's, of course, why I suck at marketing.
Well, yeah, because you have to self-promotion. Toot your own
horn. You know?
Yeah.
And was probably part of the reason why I suck at query letters, too. Or feel yeah. like I suck at query letters. Because I don't have any kind of confidence or sense of entitlement when it comes to promoting myself.
And you need to.
Right.
That's the promotion part, but it's hard. That's why you need an agent. We gotta find you an agent.
Yeah, find an agent.
They're the ones that are supposed to be tooting the horn.
That's why I need a runkle. Are you gonna say something now?
Yeah.
Are you?
Huh?
I was talking to the cat.
Oh, how is the cat?
She's doing fine. She's been walking around at my feet, meowing and wanting up on my lap. So I pick her up.
Yeah.
And dead silence.
That's all she wanted. Now she's happy. She doesn't need to talk.
Right. Oh, well. That's the other thing. You know, I got the cat right about the same time I got the cold, so I couldn't tell if it was me having a cold or reacting to her dander.
Yeah.
Because you kind of... One thing I've noticed is that you kind of have to get used to a cat, for me anyway. Some people just mm-hmm. flat out have a cat allergy. And I don't think that I do, but I usually have a tolerance level. There's a certain amount of acclimation that comes in there. And I think this kitty's been having to get rid of not only her own dander, but the four other cats and two dogs she lived with dander.
Ooh. Yeah.
Right.
The zoo.
Wow, that conversation took a broad left turn right there. That's called deflecting, getting away from the discomfort.
Yep.
I don't know. I'll figure something out. But yeah, I think probably going to a conference might be a really good step if I can find a conference that's not too far away, that doesn't cost too mm-hmm. much, and still gets a decent selection of agents and editors there.
Just that.
Right. So
There's got to be one.
I'll try and find one. I mean, now's the good time to start looking for them because it's the first of the year.
Yep.
And poets and writers will start putting those things in the magazine more often. Everybody's getting their shit together, and I got a full 2 weeks of vacation, so.
Oh, good.
I need to use it.
Yeah, take advantage of the other ones. I think you'd really enjoy being around. You'd be around other writers, and just, you know, it'd be really good.
Yeah, I'd like to go to AWP some year.
Yeah.
But my timing just never seems to work out on that. There was one year where I'd gotten the registration in on time for the early bird stuff. I'd done all this. I was talking to a friend of mine about, you know, possibly sharing a room. And then my car blew up.
Yeah.
I was like, motherfucker. And it's just like just recently, right around my birthday when I was thinking about, you know, coming out to Colorado.
Yep.
And the car blew up.
Yep.
And the car blew up.
Freaking car.
Yeah. And part of me thinks that it's a subconscious thing. I torpedo my own efforts to travel because I don't like to travel. But I think that uh-huh. I would like to travel because I like going other places. And when I think about the idea that I'm never actually going to see something like Venice and the canals and the Sistine Chapel and Notre Dame and the Great Wall of China and the pyramids. If I think that I'm not ever actually going to see things like that, it just sends me into this spiral.
Yeah.
That you know. But man, I just can't seem to get out from underneath that fear of destitution. Is that a word?
Destitution?
Yes. Of being destitute.
Let's make it a
word.
Well,
fuck it. Yeah, we'll make it a word. Who cares?
Yeah.
I'll open up the dictionary here in a little bit and check it out.
It sounds like a word. Does that make it a word? Does it sound like a word? How does something sound like a word? I mean, really?
Yeah. As long as you and I agree that it has meaning, it's a word.
There you go.
That was something that I heard a linguist say the other day on a TED Talk. So
that's pretty cool. We just got to the root of...
Well, yeah. I mean, that's all language is. It's yeah. a set of sounds yeah. that we meaning. Make, and a group of people have agreed that that meaning. Has meaning.
Yeah.
Right.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah. I like picking fights with the Oxford comma people, but not because I am opposed or in favor of the Oxford comma. I'm indifferent to the Oxford yeah. comma. You know, I'm Buddhist about the Oxford comma because
yeah, you're done about it.
Yeah, well, because the only arguments that I've seen from people about the Oxford comma have been, you know, they can't believe that that was taken out of the style manual in England. You know, the Oxford style manual.
Mm-hmm.
They're just upset that that was removed, and it seemed, and they seem to have this emotional resonance that this somehow is a travesty for the English language. This little comma, the third comma in a sequence,
which I think is necessary. But anyway, I'm not very big.
Well, that's because you were trained as a journalist, Laura.
Yes. Right. Before that, I always put commas in.
Yeah. And
the sentence looks naked without that. That comma.
Yeah. And then there are people...
I always want to group the last two things together without it. And then it'd be totally separate.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is that for the jokey, let's make a comedic point about the Oxford comma, they pull out these sentences like, Bob said he would bring the strippers, Kennedy and Lennon. And, you know, when you put the Oxford comma in, you know it's a list and that the strippers,
yes.
Kennedy and Lennon are three different things. And when yeah. you take out the comma between Kennedy and Lennon, then
you
think that the strippers are named Kennedy and Lennon, or that the yeah. strippers are JFK and Vladimir Lenin.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. See?
Which to me, I look at that and I go, no, your order is wrong. You never lead with a plural pronoun and follow with two proper nouns. Never. Because that's when you create the confusion.
Yeah.
So it's like, I would like to thank my parents, God and Mother Teresa. Because if you say that out loud, listen, yeah. in speech... Oxford comma or not, that sentence sounds fucking ridiculous. Right?
Yeah.
In speech.
It does.
Oxford comma or no. You can't, if I'm talking to you just right now, you don't hear, quote unquote, the Oxford comma. It's a
no.
structure problem. So what you would want to do in those types of sentences is go, I would like to thank God, Mother Teresa, and my parents. And then at that point, the Oxford comma becomes questionable, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I would like, Bob said he would bring Kennedy, Lennon, and the strippers. It's all about sentence order. It's all about word order in
true.
The sentence, which is the go ahead. No.
Oh, go ahead. Finish up.
It's the fun... Word order is fundamental. It's the basis of meaning in the English language because we don't have a declension system. We don't have a case ending system like Spanish
yeah.
or French or anything like that. So putting words in the proper order in English is fundamentally important. It's the most important thing in our language. after words True. Themselves is putting them in the right order.
But people are lazy.
True. And using a comma to compensate for your laziness is pathetic. That's my argument. Using a comma.
Remember when Kip was, well, this was from the movie anyway, when Kip was reading, you know, and he's like, something, comma, blah, 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 comma, blah, 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 and full stop. You know, it's like, the comma is important.
No matter how you say it.
Yeah, no matter how
it's
you say it.
It's saying that,
But most kids these days, and like, you know, this thing is like, if you think about it, they can't read, they can't write.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to explain how to use that and which.
Oh, my God.
A very simple concept for my juniors. I tried to describe that and which. And I said, if you use the word which, you want a comma in front of it.
Right. Because what follows
which should
be.
If you use the word that, you don't need the comma. That's all I want you to know. That's when you use, don't put a goddamn comma in front of that. That's what I told them. I didn't say goddamn, but I might have.
Right,
and they were just looking at me with this blank stare, like, what?
You have to.
What is she talking about?
They
like, oh my God.
That's because they don't understand the difference between a dependent and an independent clause.
No. Oh God, we tried that too, and that was just horrible.
Comma which is followed by an independent clause that could be a sentence by itself. That doesn't need a comma because what follows that is a dependent clause that is part of the initial.
Exactly. Yeah. I know. I tried.
I know. I had to teach that too when I was taking composition.
Oh, yeah. Isn't it horrible? You just get this look of like, X squared plus the square root of Y equals, and they're like, whoa! I'm talking about a goddamn comma.
Right. Oh, man. No. That's what I think, to get very broad on this, I think that's what I love the most about the English language and also hate about it, is that here I am. I have 2 degrees in English. Right. And I still will go, two or three weeks and think I've got it all under control. And then I have to go back and remind myself and look it up, the difference between effect and affect.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, I knew this. I should know this. I have 2 degrees in. Oh, fuck you.
Yeah.
No. So it's a constant English is a constant exercise in humiliation.
Yeah. Well, we always use the word affect. It's my job too. So there's effect, effect, and affect.
Right.
I'm like, oh.
Yeah, the rarely used affect as a noun, which is purely a psychological term.
Yes, which is how I end up using it most of my time now.
Right.
So, yeah. Yeah, flat affect. The first time I read that, I went, whoa, what? Flat affect? I went, oh, duh. Like, okay, I'm working in a hospital.
Now, the great thing about the spoken language is that a little bit of slurring will cover up a lot of mistakes. So that's why it's great to have a deep conversation about really important things while you're drunk.
Of course, you're slurring all the time. Yep.
That way, good your word idea. Use. No one knows whether or not you're using an Oxford comma.
No, nope, and you just follow up with "I love you, man," and it's all good.
That's the effect, man. I love
you. Or is it the affect? What?
Effect. Just drop the first
effect.
Vowel
effect.
And.
Effect. Okay. Yeah.
Effect.
Apostrophe.
Effect.
Yeah. You die like. When in doubt, you're not sure what it is? Possibly sex.
Oh, man. So that's what I've been wrestling with the last week or so.
Yeah.
Fuck it. So how's the job and the nursing study
it's good.
Going all right?
I'm very pissed off at school, but I'm really enjoying my job.
Okay.
I thought I loved school. I was like, I really love school. I don't. I love going to school for a particular thing.
Right.
I don't like school in general, which is what I thought I did. I don't.
Well, no.
I liked going to school when I got to read novels and write papers on novels, and I got to write stories, and I got to talk to other people about their stories. And
Right.
I don't like what I'm doing right now for school.
Yeah.
But I'm looking at it, and this is where I'm at with that. I've decided, I'm like, you know, this is for me to make money, to have, you know, this is not my passion.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, nursing should be a passion. Ah, fuck you, it's not. It's a job. And I'll fucking say that.
Right.
You know, and I feel bad about it, but it's true. I really do. I love the kids I work with. I feel, you know, like I'm making a difference. I'm making a difference in these kids' lives, hopefully. Keeping them from breaking their hands or punching walls or,
right,
which is what happened last week, all week I was doing that. But it's not my passion.
Right.
And I started thinking, I'm like, you know, I'm very happy. I'm getting married soon. I've got a good job. Everything's going well.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm fucking miserable too.
Right.
With myself. And that's because I'm not doing what I just absolutely love.
Right.
Which is anything that has to do with fucking language.
Right.
And writing and words and right. books.
Right.
Like I bought this desk diary at Barnes & Noble, was on clearance.
Uh-huh.
And it was like a literary desk diary. It was like this big book.
Uh-huh.
And it had, like, you know, inside were things like little vignettes on authors. And, you know, and I opened it up this morning, or today, and I smelled it. I'm like, oh, that smells so good. It's
the
like a
perfume
calendar.
Of the
I'm
blank
gonna,
page.
Yeah, I'm never going to use it. I don't use desk calendars or any kind of planner. I just don't. And I bought it anyway because it looked cool. You know?
Right.
Well, this is cool. I'm like, oh my God. And like I was talking to that guy, actually he's the guy that inspired the Elf King. He is the Elf King.
Uh-huh.
Was talking to him about the James Dean story, and I got all excited. I'm like, oh yeah, I really want to do this, you know, and because he was going to do a short film
uh-huh.
where James Dean, Marilyn Monroe, and Elvis were all transported to the future. It was to be kind of a comedy.
Right.
And because he's a singer, actor, and he grew up, he was homeschooled, and his parents were like perfect acting troupe or something weird.
Huh.
And so they did these shows where like they were based on, you know, 50s music and stuff like that. So he's very 50s oriented.
Right.
And so he was talking about that. Like I was like, you know, I'm like, God, that would be so cool. Why am I not doing that? You know? And so I'm trying to figure out how to separate my job from the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is hard because I work nights and I work 12-hour shifts.
Mm-hmm.
It's tired all the time. But
yeah,
I don't know.
How many? So you work 12-hour shifts. That means you're on. Are you on like a 4 and 3 schedule or?
Well, in theory. They've been assholes lately and they've been trying to get me to be on call. And I'm like, I already pick up 2 extra shifts a month.
Right.
Well, you got to pick up 2 extra shifts. I'm already doing that. So now I'm probably working 4 or 4 or 5 and 3 or 5 and 4.
Well, that's.
Yeah, it's, I work at least 36, usually 48 hours a week.
Right, right. Right. But in compact things, and then you've got 3 or 4 days off, right?
Right. But the problem is the problem with working nights is that the day after is
uh-huh.
gone. Did you sleep?
Yeah, yeah. And with working nights, you run the risk, you run an elevated risk of depression.
Yes, and I'm always at risk for that. And, you know, the way that's the biggest solution, of course, would be, well, why don't you just keep a regular schedule where you sleep during the day and you're up all night? No.
No.
I need sunlight. I need the day.
Yeah.
I like being up like a normal person.
Right.
I
no,
don't want to be by myself watching TV at 3 in the morning.
Right.
So I run into that. But what I've been trying to figure out is a way to schedule some time for myself. So I thought, well, how about when I get up in the morning or when I get up in the afternoon, the first thing I do is some sort of exercise,
uh-huh.
which will probably last about a day. But we're going to try it. I hate exercising. But the other thing I was thinking is like, before I go to bed, have a half an hour that'll just be book time. And that'll be read for half an hour. Because, I mean, I'm not reading. I've missed that.
Right.
You know, read for half an hour, or if you feel like it, write something. But don't force yourself to do it. Don't make yourself think you're going to write for this half hour. But if you feel like writing, write. If not, read. And have that half hour be devoted to something writing related.
Right.
You know? Because I don't know. I don't know. And I'm glad I went to nursing because I'm making decent money and I'm able to take care of myself now.
Right. That's awesome.
But, you know, between you and me and the wall, you know, I regret it too. But
it's kind of,
you know,
like
when you're an adult, you have to make bad decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I told one of my kids, you know, I said, you're what, 17? She was, you know, she's in a really bad spot.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, yeah. I said, you know, she's got this situation where they're making her go home. She doesn't want to go home because of the bad place. They don't want her back, blah, blah, blah. I said, I got to tell you, kid, I was like, when you're a teenager, everything is temporary. High school is temporary. This hospital is temporary. Your home is temporary.
Mm-hmm.
You have so many options
right
now. I said, you can do what you want later. I said, right now, you're just forced to do what everybody else wants you to do because you're just a kid.
Right.
That's what happens. I said, it's all temporary. Nothing's bad. You do whatever you want. Everything's going to change. Everything is going to change.
Right.
So don't feel like your whole world is right now and this is it and this is the way it's going to be forever because it's not. And then I told her, I said, when you get to my age.
When you get to my age and you've made bad decisions.
Yeah, that's what I told her. That's what I said. You know, I said, as long as you make good decisions, people will leave you the fuck alone.
Right.
They will leave you alone if you make good decisions. If you don't make good decisions, people fuck with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's just the way it goes.
Or you find yourself in a desperate situation, or
find
yourself, you know, fundamentally and spiritually compromised.
Right.
That's a little too close to home.
Yeah. Yeah, you make. I can pinpoint when I fucked up.
Yeah.
With my career.
Yeah,
I can.
Too.
It was when I decided. Actually, this is kind of going to sound strange. It's when I decided to start medicating myself and when I decided to get a promotion at Target.
Mm-hmm.
That's when it all went to hell.
Right.
Because my original plan was, I'll work at Target, make whatever an hour, just be a, you know,
mm-hmm.
little department head, and write. It'd be perfect.
Right.
That's all I need. That's all I need.
Yep.
But I was nuts. And so I started taking medication and suddenly it was like, oh, no, I could be a grown up. I need to make more money and take care of myself. And that's when it all went to hell. That's when I lost it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do I regret being on medication? No.
Right.
Not at all. But, I don't know. I regret it and I don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a sacrifice that I'm not sure was worth it.
Yeah. It's always a two-stage type of thing, isn't it? Because I think mine was when I poo-pooed and didn't follow Jen's advice and start adjuncting right away after graduate school.
Yeah.
And the other one was probably leaving Boulder.
Yeah, that was a big one. I can see that.
And coming back here.
Yeah.
You know, I was worried about finding a job in Boulder, but it would have been probably a better job market for me than it was back here.
Yeah.
So that was it put me in a corner, basically. So, yeah.
Yeah. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Just that when things aren't temporary anymore.
Right.
When your decisions can make permanent changes.
Exactly.
But you do stuff because you have to take care of yourself.
Right.
That's the basic need. You know, that's Maslow's hierarchy. It's your basic need. I've got to take care of myself.
Right.
Working at Target for 10 to 12 bucks an hour, whatever I was making back then, with credit card bills and student loans, is not going to cut it. You know, I couldn't do it. And then, then another part I screwed up in was leaving Target. you know, treading all this way, I could have avoided my situation right now. I was leaving Target. It was a big mistake.
Mm.
Left it over a guy.
Ooh.
You know? And,
right.
Total fuck up on that. You know, at one point I was working two jobs to support myself and him, and we weren't even
Ooh.
Together.
Right.
He wasn't working. You know, and one day I'll write about that because that was just, holy shit. But, you know, it's,
yeah.
I don't know. Like, thinking back to, like, talking to that kid about the James Dean story, I started thinking, like, it would be really cool if I had a room. Because I bought this Life magazine, you know, special edition that had the life of James Dean in it. It was
right.
all pictures of James Dean, like, whole magazine pictures. I'm like, oh, this is cool. I'm like, if I had a room, I would just tear out all the best pictures and post them up, and I'd make a timeline on his life, and I would say this whole, you know,
right.
it was like a crime scene thing from a, you know, police show or whatever. It's all these, like, from the Psycho.
Right.
I'm like, I'll do all this cool stuff with it, you know? I don't know. I'm babbling now, but.
That's fine. you have to be somewhere right after 7:30, right?
Or 7:30
your time,
yeah.
Yeah.
6:30, yep.
Okay, well, we've got 15 minutes left, and we've had a really good conversation. Not so many ums and pauses like we did last time.
Yeah, kind of random a conversation.
Yeah. No, that's good.
That's okay.
Cool. So we'll talk again in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good.
Thanks for talking to me tonight.
Yeah, I always like doing it.
I'm going to stop the recording.
Okay.
All right, there you have it. Thanks to my diehard listeners for sticking with me through the first year and a half of the podcast. Looking forward to some more interesting conversations with future writers. Upcoming is Scott Phillips. That'll be coming out at the end of the month. So look out for that one. And I've got some other interesting writers lined up. So let's hope this all goes well. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in a couple weeks. Bye.